This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will go over the topic of cervical spondylosis from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Cervical spondylosis represents the natural degenerative process of the cervical motion segment, which can lead to cervical radiculopathy, cervical myelopathy, or axial neck pain. Diagnosis can be made with plain radiographs of the cervical spine. Treatment can be observation, medical management, or surgical management depending on the severity and chronicity of pain, presence of instability, or presence of neurological deficits. Now, let's get into the episode. Starting with epidemiology, as far as incidence of cervical spondylosis, this condition typically begins at age 40 to 50. Keep in mind that 85% of patients greater than 65 years of age demonstrate spondylotic changes regardless of symptomatology. As far as demographics, cervical spondylosis is more common in men than in women. As far as anatomic location, the most common levels are C5, C6, then C6, C7, because they are associated with the most flexion and extension in the subaxial spine. Risk factors for cervical spondylosis include excessive driving, smoking, lifting, and being a professional athlete. Moving on to pathophysiology, in terms of pathoanatomy, note that spondylosis is a natural aging process of the spine. It's characterized by degeneration of the disc and the four joints of the cervical motion segment, which include the two facet joints and two oncovertebral joints of Loeschka. It's important to know that the degenerative cycle includes disc degeneration, joint degeneration, ligamentous changes, and deformity. Disc degeneration is characterized by disc decussation, loss of disc height, disc bulging, and possible disc herniation. Joint degeneration is characterized by uncinate sparring and facet arthrosis. Ligamentous changes refers to ligamentum flavum thickening and infolding secondary to loss of disc height. Finally, in terms of deformity, kyphosis is secondary to loss of disc height with resulting transfer of load to the facet and uncovertebral joints, leading to further uncinate sparring and facet arthrosis. As far as associated conditions, cervical spondylosis often leads to the clinical conditions of cervical radiculopathy, cervical myelopathy, and discogenic neck pain. Now, let's talk about the mechanism of neurologic compression. We'll go over nerve root compression, or central cord compression, secondary to central stenosis. So starting with nerve root compression, this leads to the clinical condition of radiculopathy. Foraminal spondylotic changes are secondary to chondroosseous spurs of the facet and uncovertebral joints. A posterolateral disc herniation, or a disc osteophyte complex, is between the posterior edge of the uncinate and lateral edge of the posterior longitudinal ligament, or PLL. This affects the exiting nerve root. For example, C6, C7 disease will affect the C7 nerve root. Finally, in terms of foraminal soft disc herniation, this affects the exiting nerve root. Again, C6, C7 disease will affect the C7 nerve root. Moving on to central cord compression, secondary to central stenosis, this leads to the clinical condition of myelopathy. This occurs when the canal diameter is less than 13 millimeters, with normal being 17 millimeters. Keep in mind that central cord compression is worse during neck extension, where the central cord is pinched between a degenerative disc anteriorly and hypertrophic facets and an infolded ligamentum posteriorly. Moving on to imaging, let's go over radiographs, MRI, CT myelography, and discography. So common radiographic findings include degenerative changes of the uncovertebral and facet joints, osteophyte formation, disc space narrowing, end plate sclerosis, and a decreased sagittal diameter. Keep in mind that cord compression occurs with a canal diameter of less than 13 millimeters. Keep in mind that radiographic findings often do not correlate with symptoms. On the lateral X-ray, it's important to look for sagittal alignment and the size of the spinal canal. On the oblique view, it's important to look for foraminal stenosis, which often is caused by uncovertebral joint arthrosis. Finally, on the flexion and extension views, it's important to look for angular or translational instability. Also be sure to look for compensatory subluxation above or below the spondylotic/stiff segment. Moving on to MRI, axial imaging is the modality of choice and gives the needed information on the status of the soft tissues. It may show disc degeneration, spinal cord changes, otherwise known as myelomalacia, and it's also useful for preoperative planning. Keep in mind, however, that an MRI has a high rate of false positives. Specifically, 28% of patients greater than 40 will have findings of a herniated nucleus pulposus or foraminal stenosis. Moving on to CT myelography, this modality can give useful information on bony anatomy. and is most useful when combined with intrathecal injection of contrast, which is the myelography part of CT myelography, to see the status of the neural elements. Contrast is given via C1 C2 puncture and is allowed to diffuse caudally, or it can be given via a lumbar puncture and allowed to diffuse proximally by putting the patient in Trendelenburg position. CT myelography is particularly useful in patients that cannot have an MRI, for example in the setting of a pacemaker, or if they have artifact from hardware. Finally, discography is a modality that is controversial and is rarely indicated in cervical spondylosis. The approach is similar to that used with ACDF. Risks include esophageal puncture and disc infection. Finally, as far as the clinical presentation of cervical spondylosis, this can manifest as axial neck pain, cervical radiculopathy, and cervical myelopathy. To learn more about cervical radiculopathy and cervical myelopathy, be sure to look out for their separate respective podcast episodes. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few quick questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. A lateral cervical spine radiograph of a 70-year-old female who presents with 2 months of posterior midline neck pain that is worse with motion shows spondylosis at multiple levels. There is disc height loss, facet sclerosis, and anterior osteophyte formation. She has no history of trauma. She denies any symptoms of arm pain, gait instability, or dexterity problems with her hands. Physical exam of the lower extremity shows 2+ patellar reflexes and flexion of the great toe with the Babinski test. What should the patient be told regarding these radiographic findings? And the choices are 1, she requires surgical decompression to prevent progressive neurologic deterioration. 2, 85% of individuals over the age of 60 years of age demonstrate these findings. 3, she is indicated for MRI to rule out cervical radiculopathy. 4, she would benefit from modalities such as heat, cold, and transcutaneous electrical stimulation. And 5, she has less than 10% chance of having symptomatic improvement with non-operative treatment. The correct answer to this question is 2, 85% of individuals over the age of 60 years of age demonstrate these findings. So the patient in the question stem has symptomatic cervical spondylosis. She should be told that 85% of asymptomatic individuals over the age of 60 demonstrate these radiographic findings. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, she requires surgical decompression to prevent progressive neurologic deterioration is incorrect, as the patient in the question stem has 2 weeks of axial neck pain with no neurologic deficits. She is unlikely to develop progressive neurologic loss with these findings. Answer 3, she is indicated for MRI to rule out cervical radiculopathy is incorrect, as cervical radiculopathy is a clinical rather than a radiographic diagnosis. Answer 4, she would benefit from modalities such as heat, cold, and transcutaneous electrical stimulation is incorrect, as according to the article by Rao et al., they report that there is no proven benefit to these alternative modalities. Finally, answer 5, she has a less than 10% chance of having symptomatic improvement with non-operative treatment is incorrect, as the Rao et al. Article reports complete resolution of symptoms in 43% of patients treated non-operatively. To quickly review, cervical spondylosis is defined as age-related degenerative changes within the cervical spinal column. It can present as axial neck pain, cervical radiculopathy, cervical myelopathy, or as a combination of each. Radiographs demonstrate loss of disc height, arthrosis of the facet and uncovertebral joints, and end plate sclerosis. Imaging, such as cervical spine radiographs and MRI, should be interpreted carefully and correlated with clinical symptoms, as radiographic evidence of spondylosis is frequently seen in asymptomatic patients. Bowden et al. Reviewed the cervical MRIs of 63 asymptomatic volunteers with no history of cervical spine symptoms. Of those, 19% were interpreted as having an abnormality. These findings included herniated nucleus pulposus, bulging disc, and foraminal stenosis. 60% of patients over 40 years demonstrated disc degeneration or narrowing at one level. Rao et al. Reviewed the presentation, pathogenesis, and management of cervical spondylosis. In this review, they report that 85% of patients older than 60 years demonstrate cervical spondylosis on radiography. And moving on to the final question, prospective studies have shown professional athletes in which of the following sports have the highest incidence of degenerative changes in the cervical and lumbar spine. And the choices are 1, horse racers, otherwise known as jockeys, 2, badminton players, 3, baseball players, 4, volleyball players, and 5, golfers. the correct answer to this question is 1, horse racers or jockeys. So professional horse racers or jockeys have the highest incidence of degenerative changes of both the cervical and lumbar spine when compared to age-matched non-athletes. None of the other sports listed have been shown to have higher rates of degenerative spine problems than jockeys. The sports most commonly cited as having the greatest strain on the spine include horse racing, wrestling, rugby, ski jumping, and gymnastics. To quickly review, there is a significant risk of injury when working with horses. The most common acute injuries are extremity fractures from falls off the horse. Chronic injuries are also well known with a high incidence of degenerative changes of the spine, most commonly in the cervical and lumbar spine. Sirikos et al. Performed a prospective study analyzing the long-term effects of horse riding on the cervical and lumbar spine in jockeys. A 13-year clinical follow-up of the 32 jockeys revealed the following. 15 or 47% of the jockeys reported mild to severe limitations of physical activities as a consequence of progressive degenerative changes of the spine. 24 or 75% of the jockeys had degenerative lesions on the cervical and or lumbar spine radiographs compared to 6 or 18% of the jockeys in the control group. Cowley et al. Reviewed the workers' compensation claims for injuries sustained by horse racing professionals. Of the 358 horse-related injuries sustained by jockeys, 270 or 75% were associated with falls from a horse. They showed that fractures were the most common injury, with the leg and shoulder being the most common sites. There was no comment about long-term chronic injuries. That's all for this review about cervical spondylosis. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.